Well, happy Women's History Month. What I thought I'd do today is just, I guess, introduce some of the themes that I think have been emerging over the years in women's history. Some of them perhaps may be more controversial than others, and maybe we can discuss some of those themes later when we open up the panel. Certainly, I think one accomplishment that women's history has been able to do is to open up to investigation, historical investigation, the so-called private sphere. Certainly, I think before the onset or the introduction of women's history, and certainly before social history, there was a sense, I think, among many historians that the private sphere was not open, for investigation, open for research. And I think by opening it up, it's expanded the range of historical endeavor. And so there's, a lot of areas that historians are working in that certainly when I first started doing women's history, and we will not talk about how long ago that was, that no one had even thought of doing it. Put it this way, when I was an undergraduate student, I don't even think I took a social history course, because I'm not sure anybody at York University at that point was really teaching social history. So I was really trained in many respects as a political historian. Please don't tell my colleagues that. I think what women's history has also been able to accomplish is to force historians to face some of their own biases in doing research. And I think one of the reasons that women's history has been able to do this is because most of the people writing women's history and researching women's history are certainly self-avowed feminists in one form or another, although the nature of their feminism, may change. And I think they've been very upfront about this. In fact, if you read the introductions to most books on women's history, there's this always their feminist avowal, that this is written from a feminist perspective. I think for those watching this from without women's history, this is seen as a bias only perhaps because some other historians haven't been willing to face their own bias when they do research. I think in the early stages of women's history, and even now, the tendency has been to look for women that you like. I mean, that's not necessarily unique to women's history or women or historians of women. But it seems to me we're certainly at the stage now that we have to start investigating aspects of women's past that maybe some of us really don't want to know about. Again, I think because the tendency has been for historians of women to be more feminist than not, the tendency is also for historians of women to be more on the left than not. So we know very little, for example, about women who were on the right, women who opposed women's rights, women who supported movements that we may not be particularly sympathetic to. And I think this is starting to emerge. You certainly see it in the British context, European context, and American context. And I think it's going to happen here sooner or later. I think perhaps there is a closeness between what historians of women study and who the historian actually is, a closeness that may be absent. I mean, I certainly am open to correction on this, but my sense is there perhaps may be a closeness between what we study and who we are than in other historical endeavors. One of my colleagues says that he listened to me giving a paper once, and he said there was a certain irony in the way that I delivered my papers. And he thought that he sort of recognized this irony in a lot of historians on women, particularly those of us who are women. And he thought it was a way that we had of defending ourselves, of sort of protecting ourselves from the closeness, to distance ourselves from what we were talking about. I think there are certain problems in doing women's history, particularly in this country. I think it's a very isolating experience. I think doing history at all is an isolating experience, but I think women's history, particularly in the early years, was very isolating because we tend to work in a vacuum. It's very difficult, for example, to find a number of people who are working sort of just in the same area that you're working on. For example, I can find lots of people who are working on women's history in Canada, but I can't find a lot of people really who are looking at medical treatment of women. And I only say that because if you go to any kind of academic conference in the United States on women's history, what immediately strikes you is the overwhelming numbers of people who are doing women's history in the United States. And so what it means is that they can feed off each other. Their research can feed off each other. And so it often means that there's a sophistication, I think, in their analysis that may be missing in the work on Canadian women. The positive side of that is that you really are a pioneer when you start looking at women's history, because there's so little that has been done, and there's so much that still needs to be done. So that in itself can be terribly exciting. I think my sense is that we're still very much at the recovery stage of Canadian women's history, still trying to find out what happened, as opposed to analyzing what happened. We're still more interested, I think, in fleshing out information than fleshing out explanations. And I think we comfort ourselves by saying, oh, well, we've gone through several historiographical stages. You know, we've gone from one to another. And I think we tend to be very Whiggish in our interpretation of our progress, that somehow each stage is better than the last stage. And it seems to me that while we may be adding different sort of dimensions to our investigations of Canadian women, we also seem to lose some of the strength and the positive aspects that were inherent in some of those earlier approaches. And I just want to go through some of those approaches to give you a sense of what I'm talking about and some of the problems that I see emerging. And it seems to me, if you look at any kind of historiographical essay on Canadian women, excuse me, what they usually describe is we first start looking for the women greats, you know, the great women theory of history to replace the great man theory of history. And once we get beyond the women greats, then we start looking at the oppression of women. And then we step beyond the oppression of women and looked at women in a much more positive aspect, that is, what women were able to do within that oppression. So seeing women not as passive victims, but actors of their own lives. I think from there we got into a study, and I think we're still in that, looking more at women's culture and trying to define what women's culture. And I think, as I said, we're still there, but also I think we're also much more involved in the whole issue of gender and how gender works with women's history in terms of its interrelationship with other variables such as class, you know, ethnicity, race, religion. Well, I just want to go through those stages and sort of point out perhaps some of the strengths of them that may have been overlooked in our eagerness to sort of shed them. In terms of the women's great theory of history, it was fairly quickly rejected by at least academic historians. The study of women's greats tended to be, I think particularly in the early years, tended to be written by those people who weren't in the academic field. That is, they were not trained historians. And I think feminist academics tended to reject that simply because feminists generally rejected hierarchy. And so the argument was that, you know, there shouldn't be a hierarchy of women. Some women are not more important than other women, and we really need to go and find out about, you know, I hate to use the term real women, you know, in the past. But it seems to me in rejecting sort of the study of the women greats, we've also lost an inspirational aspect to our work. And it seems to me that inspirational aspect is the strength of popular history. And I say that simply because when you look at the books that are selling from bookstores, history is very popular. But not academic history, not the history that most of us write who are working in universities, but it's the Pierre Burtons who are selling the books. And I'm certainly not suggesting we should all go out and be Pierre Burtons, but it seems to me that we should be able to learn from people, you know, like Burton, in terms of what is it that, what formula has he found that speaks to Canadian people in general? And it seems to me, I think there's an enthusiasm about popular history that may be missing from academic history. That is, if you talk to people who are doing women's history, there's an excitement, you know, when they talk to you one-on-one but the excitement may not necessarily be there when you actually read what, you know, they're publishing. Because what you end up doing when you're an academic is you distance yourself, and you have to have that separation so you appear to be serious, because there's this sense that if there's too much enthusiasm there, if there's too much commitment there, then you're not academically respectable. And then you have problems dealing with your colleagues, frankly, you know, in terms of how they look at what it is that you are doing. Well, that's the women's greats model, and I certainly am not suggesting that we go back to that, but I'm suggesting that we not lose some of that early enthusiasm. So I said, from there we went into the, you know, the oppression model, women as victim. And certainly it seems to me that what we were focusing on at that point was the whole domestic ideology, woman as wife, mother, and homemaker, and the kind of limitations that it placed on women in the past and even in the present. And certainly it's out of that context where the whole issue of patriarchy comes, the whole concept of patriarchy. And it seems to me we've accepted that kind of ideology, but we haven't really analyzed it. We haven't really investigated how patriarchy works. We haven't investigated the nuances of it, how it shifts over time. It seems to me what has tended to happen is that it's been treated as some kind of unchanging force of causation, like urbanization and industrialization. We no longer have to explain change over time. We now can say it's urbanization, industrialization, and for women it's patriarchy. And I think we've gotten to the point now that they're not explanations anymore, because we're no longer looking at what these terms actually mean. Well, from the victim approach, we went to a much more positive view of women. That is, instead of seeing women as passive and sort of oppressed by the system, patriarchy, around it, rather looking at what women were able to do within that system. So we gave some agency back to women. And it seems that a major focus of that has been looking at women and work. I think if you look at the Canadian historiography on women, that's a major theme. Women's involvement in the paid labor force, but also women's involvement in unpaid labor. And I think this has been a real step forward, that is, the distinction between paid labor and unpaid labor, and the focus on the fact that unpaid labor is very significant, you know, for our society, for the development of our economy. And certainly, you know, I do see that as very positive. But it also strikes me that this stress on work is all part and parcel of trying to give status to women in a way that society finds acceptable. That is, our society deems that those people who work are more significant than those people who don't work. So in order to make women seem important, either in the present or in the past, we have to indicate that they have worked. And if they haven't been involved in the paid labor force, then we have to make sure that people understand the work they did that was unpaid was significant. And I think that's been part of the thrust behind our focus on women and work. As I said, I don't want to take away from the significance of unpaid work and the focus on that, because it's opened up all sorts of areas of historical investigation. But it still means, it still seems to me, is that we're linking value to some kind of economic productive model. And that's fine if that is what we want to do. I just want to raise the issue that seems to me that is what we are doing, and ask the question, is that what we really believe a measure of a person is? That you somehow have to be tied to some kind of an economic productive model. Also, it seems to me, by focusing on female agency, we run the risk also of ignoring the real oppression that women have experienced. That is, you go from the victim model, where all women are oppressed in every aspect of their life experience, to looking at women as agents of their own lives, and then we tend to overlook some of the real problems that they've had to face. And, I mean, this is part and parcel, it seems to me, of history anyways. I mean, this is how historians work. You have one theory, then there are people come along, you know, and sort of oppose that theory and say, well, no, it's not quite right, and they may go a bit far in the other direction, and then someone else is saying, well, no, I mean, this is a bit extreme, let's bring it back. And you're constantly shifting So this is part and parcel of normal historical endeavor, it seems to me. We've now gotten involved in women's culture, which is ironic because, in a way, women's culture is just the same way, it seems to me, of looking at separate spheres, which is where a lot of us started off looking, except now we're a bit more sophisticated and we can call it women's culture and focus on differences and separation. But again, there's still the danger, I think, when you do that as a historian, that you ghettoize women. By looking at female culture versus male culture. Not that we know very much about male culture in Canada. But there is that, I think, danger of ghettoizing the women you are studying, and I think there's also a danger of ghettoizing you as a historian by saying, well, you know, you're only dealing with this, and this doesn't fit into a general scenario of Canadian, you know, history. I don't have to deal with it because we've got a course on women. It's going to deal with women's culture. I think part and parcel of looking at women's culture is also gender issues. And I think that's been a real positive aspect or contribution that women's historians have made. And it's not just women historians, it's anyone who has been looking at women, whether it's from, you know, a sociological perspective or a political science perspective. Because what gender has enabled us to do is to be much more sensitive to language and to be sensitive to how gender just permeates all elements of society. I've just finished reading a thesis that looks at gender with respect to politics in Upper Canada and looking at the language of politics. Now, here's a realm where women did not participate to any great extent, but the language of politics and the language of war, the language of patriotism, it is gender-based. And it's fascinating, you know, the way this historian, young historian has been able to examine this. But it also seems to me that gender has become the correct way of referring to women. No one talks about sex anymore. You always refer to gender. And when it first started out, it was very clear. Sex meant biological differences, and gender meant socially constructed differences between men and women. Now, when I read my students' papers, when I read other, you know, history articles, books written by other historians, gender now means women. I mean, that seems to be the politically correct way of referring to it, and I guess I'm sensitive to it simply because of my own research on the female body, where I have to deal with sex a lot. I mean, biological differences, and it's just sensitized me to the fact that people don't talk about sex anymore. And then so you start to constantly look when you're going to use that word. Oh my heavens, what signal am I sending out if I use the term sex as opposed to gender? So I think there's been a real shift in this. And I think maybe I want to conclude here.
Native woman. I am from Labrador. I was born in 1950. So I experienced two quite different lifestyles. As a child, we lived off of the land. By the time I was a teenager, most people in my village, or a good many people, had some form of waged labor. So I think that I have experienced a fairly common background to many Native people in this country. I don't know if people know much about Labrador, or I assume you know where it is at least. Labrador has three different ethnic populations, the Inuit, the Innu, and the mixed bloods. We, before the Europeans came, there were the two, and after, I guess about 1700, in the mid-1700s, there were traders who came from England, primarily England, some from Scotland and France. And they were single men who married Native women. And those people began, they, as a result, a new population came to exist in Labrador. My great-great-great-grandfather was one of those men. in Labrador, there's a very great division among the three ethnic populations based not just on ethnicity, but also on religion. The early when the Europeans came and the missionaries came, the Moravians came from Germany and they got the Inuit, and the Catholics came from France and they got the Indians, and so the mixed bloods were left to the Protestants. So throughout our history, we have had a very divided along those lines, communities throughout Labrador. This continues to exist today. There's maybe not as severely, but certainly it still is in existence. Questions of ethnicity are very important in Labrador today. There is a lot of dissent between the three different groups. They are all represented by official bodies who are making land claims, who have a relationship with the federal government. And they are not working together, but they each have their own separate body.